Okay, we are above 58,000 today as we head into what I think is going to be one of the biggest crypto weeks of the year next week. Remember, next week is the big Token 2049 event with all the big side events, Solana DevCon, Arweave DevCon, etc., etc. And I think that the altcoins next week are absolutely going to explode, but it's not going to be all altcoins. And today, I've got a brilliant panel for you guys. I've got a treat for you guys. I've got three of the top VCs in crypto, and they are all going to tell you what they're buying ahead of next week's Token 2049 and the biggest crypto week of the year. We don't often get these kind of shows where we get three of the best VCs in the space all telling you exactly what they're going to buy ahead of the week. So this is a show you really, really, really don't want to miss. It's Friday. It's our banter. Let's go, guys. Are you guys ready for what I think is going to be one of the biggest crypto weeks of the year? Maybe not the year, but at least of the last 200 days of the sideways movement. Speaking of big weeks, how many of you took the drift trade with me? I know we've gotten about 30 cents. We're up over 100%. Tell you who I know did take the drift trade, the front runners. That's the guys in our Discord. They definitely got that. If you want to join that Discord, sign up here. There's a link here there's a waiting list. It'll make you join the waiting list. Once you're in, if you don't like it after a month, you can just leave and you'll get refunded all your money. So there it is. Sign up over here. We called the drift trade there about 30 cents. Also, the front runners, when we record this, the front runners get backstage access and they actually get to meet the guests afterwards and actually ask the guests a whole lot of questions. So really is, I think, one of the best, safest communities in crypto. We've got a massive, massive, massive show today. As I said, you've got three guests. They're going to be telling you what they're going to be buying ahead of the biggest crypto week of the year next year. And I promise you, these guys are the best VCs. So remember, if you're not already subscribed to the channel, you know what to do. Join the over 1 million subscribers that are already part of our channel. One more, just subscribe. Thank you very much, whoever you were. If you are here, just smash the like button. That tells everybody that we're here and we're ready to do a big show. I'm also reminding you that our Friday banters are brought to you by NordVPN. Now, look, I know I've told you this a million times, and there's still some of you that are surfing without a VPN. If you're surfing without a VPN, it's basically like walking in the shopping mall with your pants down, right? You're basically showing everyone everything. You're showing people your IP address. You're showing them where you come from. They know exactly where I am. I'm in South Africa, Western Cape. They know exactly where I am, right? The only way to mask that and surf anonymously in crypto and make sure you're protected from hackers and governments and everybody else that wants your money is to get a VPN. Now, when you get a VPN, you can tell the system where you want to pretend to be. So let's say you want to pretend to be in Chile. I'm not going to do that because it'll just disconnect the internet. But you press that and then you are surfing from Chile or Canada. And you can basically confuse the governments like crazy. And that's exactly what you want to do. Now, a VPN costs you, just get this, okay, just get this. Get this. $3 a month, okay? $3 a month to protect your crypto and your IP address. Best thing about NordVPN, it's the only VPN that I know, and maybe I'm wrong, but it's the only one that has a double VPN, which means you get a VPN on top of your VPN, right? Nord's the only one that has that double VPN. And that means that you're really, really, really confusing people in terms of where you're at. You see, like right now, I've told that I'm in Bermuda. So I've connected now to Bermuda. Okay, so now everyone that wants to know will basically tell you I'm in Bermuda. I'm not in Bermuda. I'm still in Cape Town, just so you know that. All right, anyway, do that now. Sign up now. Protect your crypto. Make sure that you guys are safe. You want to know where that link is? You go over here. You go to the bottom of the Friday banter. Bang! There's three links over there for NordVPN, for threat protection from Incogni. Get those because that is what makes you safe in crypto. And imagine you make money, but then you lose it all to a hack. Or even worse, to governments. Don't be that guy. All right. Let's get into the big show today. Let's talk about the big question of the day. There's a big question of the day. And I think the big question is whether this sideways movement will ever fucking end. Okay? It's been like 198 days of this shit. So I'm going to bring our guests in. I've got everybody here. I've got Jose. I've got Malcolm. I've got Joe. Joe, I'm going to start with you because I think you had an opinion about the rate cuts that are potentially happening next week. And I think you said that we may get 50 basis points next week. Now, that's against the consensus. The consensus trade right now is 87% that we're getting 25 basis points next week. Do you still think we're going to get a 50 basis points rate cut out of the gates? Jerome Powell comes out of the gates and cuts by 50 basis points.
Yeah, I mean, no surprise that I have a non-consensus view on something like rate cuts. Look, the reality is that the Fed made a policy error by not being able to cut in July. And unfortunately, the futures markets are pricing 25 bips. Now, we got PCE data this morning that on a four-month annualized rate is about 1.7%. If you take the Fed's middle of the corridor at 5.33 and subtract 1.7, that's almost 3%, right? Or a little more than 3%, right? That's a huge difference in real yields. And so even though the Fed tends to price relative to what the futures markets are pricing, which is 25 bips, there is a small chance that the Fed actually does a maintenance cut, which is equivalent to a 50 bips cut next week. I find it less likely now. Last week when I tweeted about that, what you saw was the disinversion of the yield curve actually flipping positive for the first time in, I think it was 22 months or so. And that was when the futures markets were pricing 50 bips based on the NFP number and the unemployment rate ticking down 0.1%. However, that day you had a number of Fed speakers come out and actually kind of change their tune as it related to whether or not they would do 50 or 25. And so whether the futures markets were pricing 50 and 25, basically six or seven times throughout the day, flip-flopping back and forth. And so since then, what we've seen is equity markets take a hit. They bounce back a little bit on Wednesday on the CPI print. But today with the PCE number, it is clear that inflation has been tamed. It's well below target. If you look at 1 year, 2 year, 5 year inflation forwards, they're all below the Fed's target of 2%. So unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get 50 bips just because of the way the futures markets are pricing. But there is still a chance that the Fed actually does it. And here's why I think there's still a slim chance that they do 50 is that you basically have 6 weeks between the meeting next week and the election. If they get one bad data print throughout that, the markets will absolutely collapse. The markets will pull back significantly. I won't say they'll collapse, but they will pull back significantly. And the reason is the markets are already telling the Fed, look, we're going to tighten the financial conditions index by actually hitting equities. Bank stocks got absolutely decimated earlier this week. JP Morgan was down 6% in one day. That is a massive move for Jamie Dimon's company. So the markets are trying to more or less force the Fed's hand by tightening financial conditions. Will that actually work? We don't know. If you get a bad print between the middle of September and the beginning of November when their next meeting is, that could be a real problem for the Fed. And so I think they're factoring a lot of this in. The data is clearly suggesting that inflation has come down. The labor market is definitely softening with some green shoots here and there. But ultimately, the Fed, the futures markets are pricing 25. And I think we have to lean on that until the futures markets change their minds.
Yeah, I'm going to push back and say I don't ever think the Fed would waste two bullets when they can only shoot one. You know, give the market the rate cuts that it wants. Keep as many bullets in the chamber as possible for any future battles that you may need. I see rates as ammunition that the Fed's got, and the minute that they empty,
the only thing to caveat here is that think about it this way: when the Fed began its tightening cycle, they shocked the markets with 75 and then 75. Yes. I don't think anybody was expecting that. Right now, and they kept going. Right. So they went from basically, you know, call it 0-25 bips all the way up to, you know, between 5.25 and 5.5 with 150 bips in two meetings. Now, the other thing here is it's easier for the Fed to start strong and taper their rate cuts as opposed to let's do 25. Oh, shit, we're really behind the curve on this bad data print. Now we got to do 50 and 75. That narrative will really destroy Jerome Powell's legacy right now, which, frankly, he's doing a pretty decent job given the amount of criticism that he's received. This is why I think there's still a small chance that you get 50 bips because then they can taper down to 25 going forward. If they do 25 and there's an issue, they may have to do 50 or 75 at the next meeting.
Look, that is a view that we've got to take into account, that if they start aggressive, they can always turn down. I must say, I didn't actually think of that. Let's talk about the elections. Probably the most reliable chart on the Bitcoin price has been this chart over here, which has been the odds of Trump winning correlated to the actual Bitcoin price. We saw the first debate this week. Trump went in on Polymarkets. Trump went in strong. Now on Polymarkets, Kamala is slightly ahead. I mean, I saw Nate Silver, who published his thing, and he says, you know, Trump's got a 61.6% chance of actually winning the elections here. What are you guys thinking here? Like, how important is this Trump-Kamala thing? Is it like as important as the market's making it out to be? Is that what we should be tracking? Meltem, I want to ask you, because I know that you had a view here. I think you said something like, I want a candidate who makes the U.S. The U.S. the crypto capital of the universe. I mean, I think that's what you tweeted. There it is.
it was a joke because Trump said he's going to make America the crypto capital of the planet. I was like, you know, Trump is the man of hyperbole. Why not go for the galaxy, the universe? Let's like really be ambitious since we're going to be an intergalactic species soon. Fingers crossed.
So I mean, like, how important is this? How important is it that Trump wins? I mean, have we written off, if Kamala wins, is that like 4 terrible years for crypto?
Or? No. Look, I think people are placing way too much on this election. At the end of the day, like, the U.S. is a complex apparatus, right? And I think people overestimate the impact that the president has sort of on the broader functioning of the United States of America. Clearly, the Trump administration this time around, it'll be interesting to see who he appoints. I would go out on a limb and say the first Trump administration did not really pick particularly effective officials within the administration. And I don't feel that there was that much change in policy, really. You know, the Biden administration picked effective administrators, people who understand the bureaucracy, how to get things done in D.C. This will be Trump's last term, you know, unless the Constitution changes, which at this point, honestly, I would believe anything. But let's see who he puts in his administration, because the stakes are very different, right? It's second term, he can't get reelected, so it gives him a bit more leeway. I think what's interesting, so on the Trump versus Kamala question and the impact on crypto, Standard Chartered, which, by the way, used to have great crypto research, stopped covering crypto, just started covering crypto again. First report they put out is price outlook on Bitcoin based on election outcomes. The way they're looking at it, Standard Chartered, again, very respected. I think they do a good job with their analysis. If Trump wins, they see Bitcoin going to 125. If Kamala wins, they see Bitcoin going to 75. That's a huge differential. But again, under either candidate, I think once there's clarity on the path forward, right now, everyone is offsides, right? Everyone's sort of sitting by trying to figure out what's going to happen. Two big questions are, what's going to happen to rates? What's the outcome of the election? Once that ambiguity is resolved, people are going to allocate. Like, the market is the market. People are not going to sit offsides in cash. They're going to deploy. And so I think it's really just a waiting game right now. People are waiting for certainty in a fairly uncertain sort of environment. I think regardless of who the candidate-elect is, we're going to see movement because there's clarity, right?
Movement up or movement down?
I think movement up. People are gonna start deploying. They're not just gonna sit in cash. The sell-off that we saw based on uncertainty, right? That's gonna have to get redeployed because you don't get paid to do nothing if you're an investor. You don't get paid to just sit.
So, I mean, question: who do you think is gonna win? Let's just get straight to the point. Who do you think is gonna win? Based on the information that you have today, which is 50-odd days before the election, what does it look like? What does it feel like to you? Reason why I ask is because if I look at Poly Markets, and I like Poly Markets because this is where you're actually putting money down behind your bet. Yep. Kamala's ahead. If I look at Nate Silver, Trump's way ahead. Gut feel, who's winning here?
Okay. My view, controversial view, I think Harris is going to win.
Okay, fair enough.
And the reason why, she's running a better campaign. She's just, her campaign is a well-oiled machine. If you look at what happened in the debate, the way she was able to bait Trump, the way she had her talking points down, she was able to appeal to very specific constituents in swing states with her comments. She was highly coached. She was highly trained. She was hitting all of the right notes. Trump historically has been a good debater. I did not think he showed well in the debate. He got baited. He responded. He did exactly what you would expect him to do. And his message is garbled, right? If you look at the clips coming out of Trump, they're literally memes over how absurd some of his commentary is. If you look at the memes coming out of Kamala, like, she had good takes that appealed to specific constituents who are on the fence and undecided. And so I think just, I don't care to share my politics because it's frankly irrelevant to this conversation. I do think Harris is running a better campaign. I do think she is more likable. I think the Vance pick, honestly, is very confusing from the Trump camp. Like, I don't know what that is, but it's not good. So I think she's running a tighter campaign. I think she's going to close the gap. And there are 6 states that are going to decide the election. In those states, she has more money. She's running a good campaign. She has a great team. She's running a really tight playbook. Like, She's going to crush, I think, in those swing states.
Joe, you're nodding. You're not in agreement.
Joe, give me your hot take.
I mean, look, so it's a fucking coin flip. I mean, it's so tight, but like there's one thing, as we sit here today, I completely agree with Meltem. However, one thing to note is that when Trump survived his assassination attempt, that was the same amount of time as between the debate and the actual election. So there is a lot of stuff that can happen between now and then. And yes, Trump, arguably not his best performance. Completely agree. Kamala looked like she had her shit together, candidly. I don't think that that's debatable at this point. So do I think, as I sit here today, I think Kamala has a small edge, tiny though. And also like the polling data, I mean, Nate Silver's data is incredibly skewed relative to the other data that's out there. I think you have to aggregate these and get a better view. You haven't seen currently in the polls a huge uptick for Harris. It's been de minimis. That's why I still think it's a coin flip. And so even though, you know, when Trump survived his assassination attempt and Biden was still running, I mean, it looked like a shoe-in for Trump. That's a very different perspective as we sit here today, given his debate performance, as well as the fact that Kamala, to Melton's point, is actually running a pretty well-oiled machine style campaign and staying on message and on brand. However, the only thing I will kind of follow up with is there's the same amount of time between when he got shot today versus the election. And so if you recall during the Clinton-Trump election campaigns in 2016, the FBI dropped something like a few days before the election. And I'm not suggesting that they're going to do something.
But the point is
that nobody actually really can factor in these kind of, you know, call them idiosyncratic, almost black swan style events to a campaign election team. And so that's why with the amount of time that there's left, I still think it's kind of a coin flip.
Jose, what do you think?
On the election?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Yeah, I think it's a coin flip. I mean, when Trump, with the assassination attempt happened, I thought he was a lock-in for sure. So it is crazy how fast things change. And so many people were telling me he was a lock-in. I mean, the debate was pretty painful to watch, honestly, on both sides. Like the moderator was definitely biased, but yeah.
My only thought after the debate was, I need a lobotomy. If this is what we're doing, like regardless of what, I don't care what the outcome is really that much. I just like, I know I need a lobotomy because the next 4 years are going to be hell.
Well, I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking if Kamala does win and I have to watch her every single day on TV talking about something, she makes you feel like she's a school teacher and she's talking down to you. And like to me, it just feels like, I don't know. Anyway, that's a personal view. Coinciding with the election is the what I'm calling the FTX stimulus. And what it is that you've got $16 billion or so of FTX money flowing back into the market. Now, I know a lot of this money is actually held by people that have bought claims, right? So I don't think $16 billion is going to go into the market. What do you think the real number is? And how much of it do you actually think is going to go back into crypto?
I saw some analysis from like Split Capital that put it around 2 billion. And I've seen a couple of reports that were anywhere between like 1.5 and 3 billion of that will go back just based on what's already been sold to debt firms and stuff like that. I mean, I'm part of that number and I'm definitely plowing mine back into crypto. And I think there's probably a lot of people who will do the same, but yeah, I've seen estimates in the order of like,
and you haven't sold your claim? 2 billion. You haven't sold your claim?
No.
Why didn't you sell your claim when you could have got 101 to your claim or something like that?
Honestly, I just couldn't be bothered to like go through the whole stuff with the lawyers and things like this. Like I've just had too much stuff on to be bothered doing it. I looked into it early on when there was, I actually spoke to Galois about it because he ran an auction for his like pretty early on. And I kind of considered doing that, but then it just seemed like a huge hassle.
Joe, Joe, I know you're in touch with a lot of VCs and Silicon Valley, et cetera. Like, what's your view here? Have a lot of people sold their claims or a lot of people actually holding them?
Well, there's no doubt a lot of people have sold their claims. That's what distressed funds actually do. They look for these types of opportunities and, you know, kind of weigh the probabilities of the outcomes. I mean, claims were trading like single digit pennies at the very beginning and then, you know, into the teens and of course ripped much higher from there. That's a huge ROI for folks that run distressed vehicles. I think that the thing that I look at is what's the dollar amount that's going to come back in the market? The answer is nobody has a fucking clue. So you have to discount at some level. So let's say there's 16 billion. You want to discount it by 50%? Okay, there's 8 billion. You want to discount it by 90%? All right, it's 1.6 billion. On the one hand, the institutional side, some of these folks that end up buying claims, you know, I think they start getting money later this year, like pretty good reason to take profits. Yeah, right into the end of the year and book their carry and pay bonuses in Q1. So you have to factor that in. But on the retail side, I think a lot of folks, you're going to see some folks that have just, you know, give me my money back. I'm out. Forget crypto. I don't think that's the majority of folks that have been involved, because if you were trading on FTX, you were probably pretty committed to something like crypto. And so I do think that you're going to see a reasonable amount. Just apply a discount and that reasonable amount will likely come back into crypto. Is it all going to come in one fell swoop? Probably not. But I think you also have to evaluate where that money's going. What sectors will it be going into? So are they going to be going to meme coins, AI, the majors like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Solana, a blend of those things? That's how we kind of factor this stuff in at Asymmetric. We want to give a discount to the amount of money that's potentially coming in, create some sort of base case around that, and then model out where this could potentially be going and look at the kind of, you know, the valuations of those particular sectors and the tokens associated with them and figure out which ones make them the best risk return profile for those tokens.
Okay, listen, you went there. I didn't want to go there that quickly, but you went there. So let's talk about where money is going to start flowing. Last time we were on the show, I'm going to bring it up. I mean, you were bullish ETH. You said ETH was bullish. How are we feeling today about the ETH trade? And I hate putting you on the spot because 90% of your calls have actually been like spot on here. I'm picking on you for the one where you went the other way. Are you still bullish? And the reason why I ask is because ETH is the second biggest crypto and most people are still holding some ETH at some level. How bullish are we on ETH? Like, this thing can't catch a break. It's got an ETF. It's now got an ETF, and even an ETF couldn't save it. Help me with a bull case.
ETF flows were like zero in a bunch of days. That was great. That was great. Hard to watch. I don't know. I said last time I was holding ETH still. I didn't quite know why. I'm still holding ETH, and I still don't quite know why. I do think like my sort of NAP base case for valuing L1s is still the same. That I think that like most of the really valuable applications will end up spinning out to their own like specialized execution environments, like L2s or rollups, whatever you want to call them. They'll internalize their own MEV, and that'll leave very little revenue for the L1. And actually, like the main business model for the L1 will be as like a settlement or like proof verification layer plus the money use case. And I think if that's the end game, then ETH is very well positioned for that right now. Like,
but why not? Why not just be monolithic?
This is played out with the L2.
But just be monolithic, be on one chain. Why do you need to be on a side chain or a specialized chain? Solana's quick, it's fast, it settles like in a matter of seconds at hardly any fees. What do I need side chains for? And I mean,
there's just a lot of stuff you can't do on Solana, right? As evidenced by like there's now seven, you know, different forms of L2s on Solana. I mean, I don't know if you guys are subscribers, but Delphi recently published a report called Solana the Modular about a year after our original report on Solana, which was like at the very lows, we're very bullish, Solana the Monolith. And yeah, Solana is definitely now seeing like kind of what you'd always predict, which is L2s emerging, both because they can't get the kind of scalability that they want at the L1 layer. Maybe they can't get the reliability that they want. Maybe there's special functions that they want, whether it's internalizing MEV or like customizing the execution environment in different ways. And I think that's always just going to happen. Like you can't run the entirety of like everything people are going to want to do on chain on a single monolithic execution environment. And to me,
Joe,
it's
do you
just
agree?
Like, is Solana? Yeah.
Joe, do you agree?
So first I will give Jose a shout out. That is an excellent piece of research. We're subscribers to Delphi. I highly recommend reading it. It's very, very good. And they make some very good points.
We'll leave a link below for anyone that wants to actually sign up to the Delphi report. I think it's fantastic. Let's just make sure we get a link in there.
So I agree with Jose to some extent as we sit here today. Can you run every single asset 24/7 trading on Solana today? The answer is no. Can we later on, when you start to see improvements with things like FireDancer, other clients coming to market, improvements to the underlying protocol? Potentially, yes. And so I do think there's a case to be made that as we sit here today, I agree. However, in the future, I think that is going to fundamentally change. And I think people will be really shocked to see what's coming at Breakpoint next week in Singapore. And so the L2-ification of Solana, in my opinion, has more to do with the application-specific centric view of what people are trying to accomplish on Solana. And so that's consistent with basically any type of software technology stack. You start to see things from cloud computing in the early late 2000s move towards vertically integrated solutions based on a particular sector, whether it's healthcare, it's real estate, et cetera. That's kind of what you're seeing happening with Solana. People are saying, hey, it's fast, it's cheap. We love the parallelized approach to managing global state. But for our use case, AKA these developers, we need to do a separate thing and ultimately utilize the underlying L1. I think that's actually great. It doesn't necessarily imply that the L1 can't scale to the extent that I think the majority of us in the Solana community believe to be true. On the flip side, with Ethereum, I mean, you know, I've gone on record all year long basically saying we've had the privilege of not owning any ETH, and it's radically outperformed
Bitcoin. I was about to ask. Yeah. So do you hold any ETH today?
No, zero. And I absolutely see no reason to. Now, remember, I'm a trader. I am in a VC, but I run a hedge fund. And so on the hedge fund side, we looked at things that actually are going to bring the most value to our LPs. And we have never had a view the entire year that Ethereum was going to do any sort of outperformance relative to Bitcoin or Solana. And it's proved to be true. If you look at the year-to-date relative value trade of Solana versus ETH, it's up like 30%. That means if you were long Solana and short ETH, you're up 30% on a notional basis. That's ridiculous, right? On the year that Ethereum ultimately had, you know, the blob storage pass, the ETFs themselves, that is not good. And I wrote about this in our latest market update. Ethereum has an identity crisis. And I think one of the challenges that Ethereum as an L1 is facing is that there's an ultrasound money narrative, and then there's the kind of world decentralized supercomputer narrative. And both of these are being eaten by Bitcoin and Solana. Solana is clearly, across myriad metrics, going to flip and has already flipped Ethereum L1 in a number of areas. The only thing that they haven't flipped is TVL. Why? Because Solana is capital efficient, just like any market in history. And on the flip side, Bitcoin is clearly dominating as it relates to the ultrasound money narrative. Then you can see this with the institutional flows. All you have to look at is the ETF flows at this point and ask yourself this question: why aren't advisors at RIAs and asset managers telling their clients to buy the Ethereum ETF? Well, they've already allocated to Bitcoin. And if they're going to get some other higher beta, the relative value trade is Solana. It's up 30% year to date.
Meltem, I'm holding a little bit of ETH. Relative to Sol, I'm not holding a lot, but I'm holding a little bit of ETH. What do you think? Should I sell it and buy more Sol? Or should I just carry on holding it and pray? I don't know.
I mean, look, I think Joe really hit the nail on the head. I'm a simple woman. I look at inflows and outflows. Where is the capital going to come from? I think one of the challenges is Bitcoin dominance is at a four-year high. It's 54%, right? People who want exposure to the crypto narrative, you could buy one asset, right, that accounts for the majority of the market and be done. That asset's been around for 15 years. It's been broadly financialized. There's an incredible amount of research coverage on it. It's well understood. It's supported by a $100 billion data center economy. It's Bitcoin. That's what people are allocating into. So if we look at these large institutional inflows and orders of magnitude that really are needed to make a difference, right, a tangible difference for a multi-billion, multi-trillion dollar asset, those are institutional flows. They're going into Bitcoin. And we see that if we look at the volume, the inflows and outflows on the Bitcoin ETPs, that's where the volume is. We look at institutional demand for ETH. Sure, there's a narrative around ETH. The narrative is unproven, and the demand is just not going into ETH. There's been zero movement on the ETFs, zero inflows and outflows. The majority of the ETF flows in ETH have been in earlier products. A lot of the flows came in 20 and 21 into products like ETHI, the CoinShares Ethereum product. And those products haven't really seen sort of accretion in terms of AUM growth, right? They've seen appreciation in terms of the price of ETH going up, but the amount of ETH in those hasn't really changed materially. So it's just a fundamentally different story. The flows are not there. And then on the flip side, ETH also has much higher inflation, right? There's an annual inflation rate in the ETH network. So you have sort of this persistent supply that's coming online. So I just think the fundamental dynamics of the amount of inflow of new capital coming into the ETH ecosystem, outflows of ETH, right? And let's not forget, there's also this really interesting narrative that I'm watching closely in ETH. It's the narrative around restaking and ABSs. Right now, a lot of ETH is getting sucked into these restaking narratives. As those projects launch and that yield gets compressed more and more, the opportunity cost of keeping your ETH in like these restaking protocols versus just selling your ETH and allocating to something else entirely becomes more and more tangible. So I'm just looking at flows. I think on Bitcoin, the flows are definitely there. I think Bitcoin flows will continue. And as macro conditions evolve, as macro uncertainty sort of gets clarified, I wouldn't be surprised if we see more flows into Bitcoin from larger allocators who've been looking at Bitcoin, have been studying it, have been talking about it with other large institutional allocators that they respect for like the last 3 or 4 years, right? It's been 4 years since Paul Tudor Jones came out and said, I want to bet on the fastest horse. That horse is Bitcoin. Now, when it comes to Solana, I think there's still a lot of upside there. Solana also has some fundamental questions, I think, around the inflation schedule and just the dynamics of inflows and outflows. Solana's inflows, I think, are very different. I think for institutional allocators who want to clip like a $10 to $50 million ticket, that's what we forget. These are not retail buyers. These people want to sling. Like if I'm doing research, if I'm covering crypto on my desk, I want to write $10 to $50 million tickets, right? I'm not making a bunch of little bets. I'm not allocating like a retail investor. There are really only three places today in the market where you can allocate in that size. And we saw a lot of demand for Solana. Solana has also performed incredibly well. If you bought Solana this year, you're up a lot. You're like outperforming on every metric. And then there's kind of this longer tail. I don't think institutional allocators are looking at the longer tail at all. Frankly, it cannot accommodate their size and the liquidity is just not sufficient. Like the venues just don't exist. So being a simple woman, inflows, outflows, what do I hold my portfolio at this point? That's not longer tail. It's Bitcoin and Solana. I hold a little bit of ETH because it's efficient for gas. And then I have some STEETH that I'm restaking just because I'm watching yields. But that's it.
Okay, you've convinced me to sell my ETH. I'm going to sell my ETH. My holding horizon is another 18 months. Okay, so I'm going to sell all my ETH today. And I'm going to buy something else, which I'm going to hold for 18 months. And I need some help from you in terms of where should I allocate the money. Now, let me give you some caveats. I don't want any more Bitcoin and I have a ton of Sol. So let's park those two out of the equation and say, I'm not going to have a significant percentage of my portfolio, which I'm going to cash out about 3 minutes after the show. You'll actually see the trade because it's going to crash the whole market because I'm going to sell all my ETH with one shot. Where do I allocate the money? Just give me some ideas of which narratives and which tokens I should probably look to put the money into. And I think the thesis for me is I believe that we're going into the most exciting part of the bull market. I believe that alts are pretty depressed and I've got to allocate my money. Where am I putting my money?
Yeah, I think it's tough out there in the liquid markets right now, honestly, with just flows for a lot of the tokens that people are excited about. Like the unlock schedules and just the increased amount of tokens launching. There's some stuff I'm excited about. Like recently we published a report on Meta, the sort of prediction market / like futarchy project on Solana. I think that's a pretty exciting one. There's not too much liquidity there, so I don't think you can dump your entire big ETH bag into it. But that's an exciting one. I think like in my own PA, like Robit's an interesting one I've been holding for a while. Like the burn at this point seems real. They've just got the deal with Southampton sorted. I don't know. That thing is trading at like something like 2x like their actual burn, right? Like the sort of burn to market cap multiple. So it's pretty ridiculous.
So I don't know if you remember, we spoke about a year and a half ago. It was about June, July, about a year ago, and Rollbit had just broken the 7 cents. And I said to you, I missed the Rollbit trade. It was at like 13 cents. I said, but I will catch it again at 7 cents. And when it got back to 7 cents, now I bought it again. And I'm so happy with my purchase because I think the fundamentals are really strong. I also think that we're in crypto because we want to buy and trade value. And I think that Rollbit is a buying and trading value platform. And I think that that's like a no-brainer in terms of winning. I also agree with you on the prediction market narrative. I think that it's a massive narrative. In fact, I think that prediction markets and meme coins combine, and we get like predictions with attention economy somehow. I don't know what it looks like, but I think something like that lands up happening. So I think a good two narratives from you. Joe, I'm keen to know where I should put my ETH based on your recommendation.
Sure. And this is absolutely not financial advice. And yes, my fund probably holds the tokens that I'm going to mention because this is what we want. So look, I think, again, Solana obviously is going to continue to outperform. You already have a big sellback. Great. Yes. Welcome. What I would actually do is look what's beta to Solana within the Solana ecosystem, so other SPL tokens. So there's a handful that I think that can have pretty significant upside, assuming that we get, you know, a ripping Q4 into the end of the year like we're expecting.
All right, I'm ready, sir. I'm ready. Okay, yeah, 1, 2, 3. Tell me what they are.
Yeah, the first would be Jito. They've got – this is a crack team. They are dominating stake on Solana, and everybody is integrating Jito bundles into their systems. You can trade it on like Jupiter as an example. Jupiter is another one. So the Jupe token, I think, actually has the potential to rise significantly in value. It is arguably the best dApp period on Web3. I don't think there's a debate around that. Also Drift, you mentioned prediction markets, right? So Drift actually is a perps DEX that has added prediction markets and has seen a significant amount of open interest and volume, considering that it is their Solana DEX does a fraction of, say, the, you know, the volume of like a Uniswap.
I must say, this is one of my favorite plays on the Solana ecosystem. Why? We invested in this thing really, really early. Actually, we invested in this thing at the last cycle. And we know Cindy and the team, and these guys are just phenomenal, phenomenal builders. And when this token came onto the market at about 30 cents, I looked and said, you know, I know the VCs paid the same amount of money and the VCs are locked up for 2 years. And that's the kind of token that I want to be investing in. So Drift for me is like, I read the Multicoin report this week, which gives them like a mid-case valuation of like 10x from or something like that. Something crazy. And I just think that Drift is one of the best teams in the market. Interestingly, all the calls that you gave were Solana ecosystem coins.
You got to let me finish. I'm not done.
I got
one more for you.
Go for it. I'm ready, sir.
Obviously, I was very early to the meme coin frenzy. Got long bonk at $28 million market cap back in October of last year. But I do think that there's another token. It's Mother Token by Iggy Azalea. The work that she's doing as a celebrity and bringing actual utility to her community. I mean, she's integrated this into Unreal Mobile, which is a mobile virtual network operator here in the United States. She's integrated into Dream Vault, which is like a shoppable application. She's integrating it into the fastest growing US music festival called Breakaway. She's actively participating in that community. And I think Mother is if you're going to have some meme coin exposure, has dramatic upside because it's sitting, I think, at like $35, $40 million market cap.
When I saw this, Joe, yeah. I thought that you were going to be against Mother Coin and this was going to land up being more of a debate. You've now opened up.
Iggy and I work together. So we're business partners on some stuff that we're going to be announcing next week. So there's like huge potential in what she's doing. And the reality is that I don't think a celebrity thus far has done anything remotely as valuable to her community and bring real utility to the community of mother holders. And she's consistently and continually going to do that. So again, yeah, I'm probably biased here because Iggy's a friend and we work together on certain things, but I'm seeing it with my own eyes. There is no other celebrity that's doing anything remotely close to what she's doing with her mother token.
All right. I mean, I must say that one caught me by surprise, but I'll tell you one thing. I didn't think that Iggy would last this long. I thought she would have dropped out like a lot of the other celebrities, and she's been grinding. Price goes up, price goes down. She's been grinding. She could be the real deal. And I do think I'm actually of the opinion, which is, I think, a controversial opinion or a contra opinion, which is that I actually think celebrity tokens are really good for the space. If we get it right and they stop being rug pulls and scams, I think if you want to bring 1 billion people into crypto, you need to get celebrities who have huge fan bases to do cool things in crypto. Now, I mean, we worked a little bit with, or I worked a little bit personally with Jason Derulo because he had a token launched, and it was a failure at the time, and he was really trying his best to make it right. And I think the message that I got was, if the celeb has good intentions and they want to experiment in our space by bringing in outsiders, and they really are doing that, I think we should welcome them and not shun them. I think we must just put in enough protections so that people just don't get ragged with celeb tokens. But I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one thing to point out here, like, you know, Iggy is very, very intelligent, and she's a savvy businesswoman. And furthermore, like, as a VC, if I was to look at her story, I would invest in basically anything she does. This is a woman that grew up in rural Australia, worked in hotels since she was 16, told her parents she was coming to the United States to visit, but stayed here, entered the rap scene as a white woman from Australia, dominated, became a massive global superstar, and then exited her music career to focus on the business side of what she wants to do, including her kind of integration and adoption with Web3. So I completely agree that celebrities are actually net positive, because when you have culture bringing forward a new technology, it's a wrap. You saw this happen with Twitter when Oprah Winfrey tweeted live on TV. All of a sudden that gave agency to hundreds of millions of people around the world that, oh, it's okay for me to use this new technology. That's the same concept that you're going to see with something like Iggy bringing more people into crypto, because her fan base has 70 million people on socials around the world. That's just unprecedented in something like crypto.
I love the fact that you've said this, because I think it's not the popular opinion. And I also, you say Iggy's intelligence. She's debating Eric Wall at Breakpoint. And Eric Wall is one of the smartest guys that I've ever met. He really is one of the smartest people I've ever met. And he's a great debater. I mean, if there's one thing that Eric Wall loves, it's, you know, I think he must be practicing his debate now much more than Kamala Harris was practicing before Donald Trump. And so I'm really, really, really looking forward to see how that debate goes. I must say, I take your point. I didn't realize that Iggy was as intelligent as you make her out to be today. I can't wait to see what happens at the debate stage. Malcolm, I'm coming to you. I've got a lot of money now because I've sold my ETH. Where am I putting it?
Deepin, baby. I'm a Deepin.
You're a big Deepin person. You really, really, really are. Tell me why you love Deepin.
Okay. It's very, very simple. Okay. We are entering, I think, a new era in tech. We're seeing SaaS bleeding, right? Like, returns to SaaS are getting compressed. Valuation multiples SaaS are getting compressed. What is everything about? Why did NVIDIA become the most valuable company in the United States, in the world, arguably after Aramco, for a brief period of time? It's because right now NVIDIA is the only way that you can play sentiment around the data center economy. Like, the next 10, 15 years, I think particularly in US markets, are going to be defined by the data center economy, the compute value chain, all the way from CapEx, right, chips, through electrification, increasing energy demand. Ton of research out there that I've shared on my profile about just what's happening in energy markets is the story nobody's talking about. If you would have allocated your portfolio 4 years ago, energy has outperformed tech by a factor of 2.
Okay.
Story nobody's talking about. It's completely misnarrative. So I think just focusing in on this narrative around compute, connectivity, electrification, it's physics, right? Like, anything digital requires physical instantiation. I've been going on about this for like the last 5 years. So I really don't need to do a lot of it anymore.
So which Deepins in particular?
That's why I started this whole new firm.
Which
Deepins I'm excited about haven't launched a token yet because I'm an early stage investor. Crucible, my firm, invests early stage, typically first check in, right? But Deepins that I'm holding today in my portfolio, big fan of Akash. I think Akash is underappreciated. Yeah. Really like Greg and the team. They were early at Terraform, which is one of my favorite infrastructure tools, like from the Web2 side. Really smart team. So very excited about Akash. The other great thing about some of these projects that have been in the market for a while is there's no longer that overhang that we see in projects that still have a lot of investor tokens that are vesting. So I actually think there's a lot of opportunity in projects that have been around for a while. So Akash is one. I'm still excited about Render. I have a fairly big Render allocation in my portfolio. Was an early investor there. Like, I do think that narrative's really potent. One project I'm really excited about that has launched earning of their token, but the token's not live yet, is a project called Daylight. They're basically gathering energy data on U.S. residential energy grids and U.S. residential energy resources. So I think decentralized energy or decentralized generation, DGEN, as some people are calling it, it's going to be a good one to watch. Projects there, very early stage. Other deepens, I think, have potential. Helium ecosystem really continuing to expand. Frankly, have been impressed by the level which the Helium team is executing. So I'm closely watching Helium. They just launched an energy subnet that I think will be interesting. So working with, talking to a lot of projects that are looking at building on that Helium infrastructure. But I think in DeepIn, the best stories are yet to come. There is a lot of vaporware. I think decentralized compute is a narrative that's definitely been overinvested. Is definitely one that I'm cautious of. And then decentralized AI, another narrative that I think's been overhyped, will sort of have a trough of disillusionment. And over the next 3 to 6 months, as I think both AI, decentralized AI, and DeepIn go through their respective cycles, there are going to be great opportunities to buy positions at really, really material discounts.
Yeah. So, I mean, I must say, I agree with most of your theses. You mentioned something there, which I want to just touch on. And you mentioned that you're only investing, or you're mainly investing either in early stage tokens or tokens that have been in the market for a long time, because you don't want to have token unlocks dumped on you. And I think that that's right now the biggest problem that we have in the market. Like, I genuinely think that the biggest problem that crypto has at the moment is inflation of tokens. Tokens coming onto the market from VCs. I think that VCs broke the market. When I say, not, it's VCs and projects broke the market. Why? They bid up the projects too high before the projects came to market. And they left no meat on the bone for the retail investor to build a community. And so when I look at tokens out there, for me, there's two types of tokens. One is the type of token that everybody loves: Solana, ETH, Bitcoin, etc. Why do they love the token? Because they've landed, a lot of people have made a lot of money because the chart started low and went high. The other type of token is token that have apathy. And like, I look at Starknet, I look at ZK Sync, I look at all those tokens.
If I can, I think what you're articulating here is my core thesis. Price is the only UX that matters in the short to medium term.
Yes.
Price is crypto UX. Like, people talk about,
It's price. I think it's a little bit more than that. You need to have a lot of people make a lot of money on your token in order for the token to build strong affinity. Yeah. In order for the token to build strong affinity. And if a token does build strong affinity, then you'll always get liquidity, because when the price goes down, people feel connected to it and land up buying it, right? And I think that like, Melton, we've been around for a while. You've been around for much longer than me, but we've been around for a while. And we know that the best feeling in the world is when you buy Bitcoin really, really early and it keeps going up and it never comes back towards your entry price, because you've just landed up buying it so early. And so you feel much more comfortable in that trade, right? I think with the new tokens, I'm going to just Aptos, ZK Sync, Starknet. There's a whole list of them. I don't have to tell you who they are. No one's made money. They have zero community. They have zero affinity to the token. What's the fix? Like, I recommended a fix, and my fix was, let the price dump, unlock the tokens, let the price dump, and let retail actually buy this thing cheap and kind of go back to ICO days where retail could actually get in at a good price. I don't know what else the fix is, but if we don't find a fix, then you're going to have a whole lot of projects that are simply not going to get liftoff. Because there's no one to buy them. Who's going to land up buying ZK Sync, Stark? Who's buying these projects?
Okay, I want to just make three quick statements. Number one, I think vilifying venture investors who are deploying risk capital is sort of a dead-end road. Like, where's capital availability to build these things going to come from? What I do think is there are a lot of very large venture funds who need to write large checks. And there isn't necessarily capacity in the market for that. So I think what you're seeing is valuation dislocations that are the result of people trying to deploy funds that are sized much too large for the asset class, right? So I think that's problem number one. I think problem number two, it's a flows problem. Okay, inflows are simply not there. And also maturation of the market necessitates that people who are allocating in size are doing much more research. They're really looking at the fundamentals of supply and demand. We didn't have that in the last two cycles. People were just kind of throwing money at narratives. I think now when people are deploying in size, they're really doing more research. We have two cycles of data that inform us on what sort of metrics to look at, what data points matter. We have data sources like Messari, Delphi, others that are actually showing visually, right? Here's the unlock schedule. People are much more educated about FDV, about circulating supply. So I think that's fundamentally changed the structure of flows just because investors are much more exacting. And then the third is there is no liquidity. Like liquidity has completely dried up. I don't think people appreciate how little liquidity there is in the market, how few market makers there are. There are much fewer prop firms. There are much fewer sort of long tail risk investors. There is so little liquidity outside of Bitcoin, ETH, and Solana. Like there is so little liquidity. And I think that is a precondition for all of the other things you just articulated. So I just think people are not appreciating the fact that fundamentally and structurally, the market is very different now post FTX, post Three Arrows, post Genesis. I don't know, Joe, you're shaking your head.
You're a VC. You're a VC. You're invested early in some of these projects that have high FDV, low float. How do you feel about those investments? How do you feel about these locked up tokens with these, I don't know, I call them funny inflated valuations? How do you feel about the tokens?
Yeah, it depends. It is the answer. It's like I really think that the low float, high FDV, or like even the FTV isn't really the right metric to look at these things at. I kind of published one a few months ago, which is like unrealized gains to market cap. I think is kind of the right way to think about what a heavy FTV is and basically how much selling there is left. Like if there's, and some of these tokens have ratios of like 6 to 8, where there's, you know, 6 to 8 times the amount of unrealized gains sitting in this token ready to unlock and like investors and team tokens versus like the market cap. And then a lot of them are also fudging their circulating market cap, so the unlocks will be even bigger. So you kind of have to look at it on a case by case basis, honestly. Some of them I think are going to really struggle. Like when you literally have an entire market cap unlocking every 2 months for like 2 years, I think that's going to be really hard on the price. I think others will like pump through their unlocks, just like Lido did last cycle, just like a bunch of the winners of last cycle did. It just very much depends on the dynamics. I do think the VCs, like clearly we've been like, I think the original sin was banning ICOs, honestly.
I agree.
Like regulating away ICOs was the original sin. For all their flaws, like the SEC just basically like erected a wall around VCs. Who like every early stage funding just became monopolized by VCs. If you wanted to raise money, you had to go to VCs, and obviously that created the dynamic we have now. And then I think centralized exchanges were also huge beneficiaries of this, and they've sort of created the meta, like the incentivized test nets, the airdrops, the points campaign. All that is to satisfy requirements created by centralized exchanges, because that's really your only way to distribute to retail if you don't have ICOs. I think ICOs will come back. We're incubating a project called Legion that's trying to bring them back. I just think they make a lot of sense.
We spoke to Legion.
Yeah.
We spoke to Legion. I mean, I love the guys, and I think they got a great, I think they could actually get it right. When it comes to market, I think it's going to be pretty interesting. Anyway, guys, listen, we're completely out of time. I mean, we've actually gone over time, but there's been so much alpha. So it's been absolutely amazing. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much. Been amazing. Joe, Jose, we'll see you next week in Singapore. Melton, we'll miss you next week in Singapore, but whatever you do, have fun. Thank you so much, guys. And to you guys, the Banter fam, thank you guys for watching. We'll see you guys again I'll see you guys again on Monday, but I'll be in Singapore on Monday doing the show from Monday. So until then, trade well, my friends.